morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today, we are going to show you a remarkable experiment involving a rolling cylinder. Sounds quite mundane, but yesterday, we got out our hammers and drills and we made an ordinary cylinder into a remarkable piece of physics. So, and to show you how this works, I'll hand you on to Laura.
Thank you, James. So, here we have an ordinary cylindrical object, as you can see. Yes? And that behaves just like normally, like how you would expect James to be set back. So, the motion is being slowed down by friction. And eventually, it will just stop being boring like that. But here we have a mystery tin. So I wonder what will happen if I roll out this one. Let's see. So first, it will slow down, stop, and wait. It's actually coming back to me. That's amazing, right? So it somehow seems to restore energy and then release it back as a kinetic energy in the opposite direction. So I wonder what's behind this phenomena. It's really amazing. Trevor?
Thank you. To explain what's going on, we made this large version of that red can over there. So what you can see is what we have done is we put a weight in the middle of the can and suspended it by two elastic bands attached approximately along the axis of rotation of the cylinder. So if you roll it, you can see what happens when she rolls it. She rolls it, you see the weight stays stationary, but the elastic bands wind as it turns. The kinetic energy is transferred to the potential energy in the elastic bands, and then when it stops, it's released as it comes back. So the point of the weight is that you need something to remain stationary for the elastic bands to wind around. Just putting a post through wouldn't work because that would spin with the can as it rolls. So to explain some more, I'm going to hand you over to Auntie.
Hello. Well, from the motion of the large jug, you can see that it acts like a damped harmonic oscillator, where the damping force is the friction. And when in rest, the object is in the bottom of a parabolic-shaped potential well, and when given some initial velocity, it will start to oscillate back and forth. And in the ideal case, without any friction, it would keep going forever. When with that, I'll pass on to James.
Thank you, Eddie. So, we've seen how an ordinary cylinder can be transformed into something fantastic by simply adding an elastic band and a weight. We've examined how this object can store its kinetic energy, then release it in the opposite direction, also its kinetic energy. We've also examined the fact that the physics of this object is that of a damped harmonic oscillator, namely the rolling will stop as the system loses energy to friction. With that, we'd like to end our presentation and invite your questions. Thank you.
I can't believe how well that works.
Yeah, it's certainly. That's cool, isn't it?
Yeah. The role of the friction, you need friction for this to work, right? There's two kinds of friction. The role of friction and the sliding friction, right? So you need the sliding friction for yeah. Otherwise it would be
that's right.
Auntie did, I believe. Auntie thought of this one.
Yeah, we found it. We have seen this in Finland.
Yeah.
And we thought it was cool, and we
yes.
wanted to build our own.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, like I have a friend that wants to be a teacher or something. So he was building stuff like this the whole summer when I was at the physics lab upstairs with their little things. And he would come up every morning having something new to show. And he was so excited about it. So I really like that.
And so this again is the same thing, just elastic band in the middle, and you have something for a weight. What are you using for a weight inside?
A rock, three nuts, and a bolt.
Very elegant.
Yeah. Yes. The rock wasn't heavy enough, so we needed to add more weight.
So tape it on.
Right.
Can you wind the cylinder off? Like by turning it with your hand and then let it go and stuff?
I think so, too.
Yeah. But
you also
need
to make sure.
Yeah,
if you made sure the weight stayed stationary, that would be okay. But if you
turn it slowly, such that the weight turned to the cylinder, and that would. This one's better, really, because it goes forward and back, and forward and back, a few times. So this one here, we can actually see the harmonic motion. This one's better. And I actually see the mechanism, too.
Yeah, although I think it's really effective the way you did it by showing first the blind box where, you know, you get the attention of people, and then you show it this way. And of course, assuming if you were to do it the other way around, it wouldn't be.
That's effective.
Awesome. Great job.
Thank you.
Who would like to go next? All right. Are we?
We're back with you.
Yeah. All right.
Good job. Thank you, sir. Good job. I think we all did very well. Well done. Bloody well done. Bloody well done. Cool. Here, I guess. Oh, no. I don't want that from you. You leave.
You want us to sit down so that.
My little concern is the smoke alarms.
Yeah.
Do you
have
to
use microphones
or? No, you can't. Oh, you're doing anything. What's that? It's not on in here, but it's on to, I believe, Holder can hear us. So. You don't need the microphone.
Apparently, you didn't use the microphone.
Yeah, it's easy to hear.
Okay.
It's better. Okay.
All right, so if I spill some water on the table, what's going to happen to it? Yeah. Okay, it spreads out, but what about a day later? What if I come back tomorrow? What's going to be there? Nothing. It'll evaporate, right? So how that happens is the molecules in the air are warmer than the ones in the water, right? They'll transmit some of their energy, kinetic energy, to the molecules in the water, they'll crash into each other, some will evaporate, water will be cool again, and the same thing will happen again and again and again until all the water is gone. So what if I put some water somewhere warmer? Say, out in the desert. What's going to happen? It'll evaporate quicker. So do you think this is a monotonically increasing relationship? Is it going to keep going? The hotter you get, the faster it evaporates? Yes? Okay, we're going to try.
How many people think yes? How many people think no? Okay.
Because we posed the question, right?
I always hate those.
Yeah.
We're going to find out. So we have?
Yeah.
Matt's going to explain.
All right. So over here on your left, we have a hot pan that's set to the very precise heat degree of 1. Whereas this one is set to the very precise heat degree of 10. So what we're going to do is we're going to put a little bit of water in each pan, and we're going to see which one evaporates quicker. So it's exactly the same amount of water. Let's see what happens.
Thank you.
what's happening? You guys can see what's happening.
Yeah, it's actually really clear in camera.
How it all slides around. And how this stuff really does it, right? And then these trails. And this clumps around things.
Guys, I'm slightly concerned about the smoke detectors, right? So,
okay.
If the sprinkler system gets set off, that would be really, really, really bad, and I get in tons of trouble for it. So,
okay. So let's take a look at what's happening here and why it worked last time and didn't work this time. Okay. So what we have here is not monotonically increasing scale, basically. So if we look at the transfer of heat from the pan to the water on one axis, we call that the rate R, and over here we look at the temperature above the boiling point, then what we're going to see is what's called the Leidenfrost effect. And that happens, what happens is that initially, as you increase the heat of the pan, it's going to evaporate faster and faster. But at some point, it's going to reach the consistency that this water did, where it sloshes around as if there's no friction between the water and the pan. And it's actually going to start to transfer the heat more slowly than before, until it reaches this point here, which is called the Leidenfrost point. And then, as you approach the temperatures of the sun, then obviously the water's going to evaporate much faster. So, you all saw on the screen what the behavior of the hotter plate looked like. We're going to say that that's somewhere in the vicinity of this Leidenfrost point here. When we did this experiment yesterday, perhaps we were more like, up here, and the rate of heat transfer was much quicker. But today, we didn't turn the plate on hot enough, so perhaps the rate of heat transfer was down here, and so it still evaporated more quickly, even though it was around this Leidenfrost point. But I'm hoping that with the hint of how the water sloshes around like that, maybe one of you can postulate why it is that the heat transfer is actually less when the water, when the pan is hotter. Yeah.
So you create a layer of the gaseous form underneath the liquid form of this. You can do it with hydrogen too.
Right, exactly. And we're also going to tell you more about
that. So when we put that water droplet in our surface, we just have a droplet like that. It's water. And when we are there, we put it heat there, but the heat, we put it at a slow enough rate that we can approximate everything at the same temperature, so it just stress no amount of operation on the surface. But when we heat that enough, it's no more the heat. Here, it's so hot that everything's there evaporates, so there's steam there, and the steam is just blocking the heat transfer. It cannot transfer easily. The droplet is on the layer of steam. The conduction is much slower than there.
So there's no convection because the layer is too small. The layer of steam is too small. No convection, so you have only radiation and conduction, but the air is a bad conductor, and as you can demonstrate, like last night we were talking about how if you have a pan at 200 degrees Celsius, if you have an oven at 200 degrees Celsius, and you stick your hand on the pan, it's much more unpleasant than sticking your hand in the oven, because here you're touching the metal, here you're touching the air. Air is much worse at conducting heat. And another cool thing that you can see, as soon as the water hits the really hot pan, as soon as the steam is formed under it, it starts to slide, and it goes to the outskirts of the pan. And you can see this on a electric stovetop,
So here's a little bit to the convex in the middle, so it would go there just because of gravity. But on the stove top, and it would just go to the outskirts because it's cold. So so you have some kind of a heating system, and it's hotter in the center, and it's colder outside because you're heating in the center. And so naturally there's a convection current, like from the very beginning. So air goes out this way, but it has to come back in somehow, so it comes in from the top. And so when you have this bubble here, and it's on a frictionless surface, the steam, so it's going to be pushed this way. And you can see this with liquid nitrogen too. If you put it on your hand, even if you cup your hand like this, it's still going to go out to the outside of your hand. So an interesting thing that happens is that it actually tumbles as it goes. So it doesn't just like flow; it tumbles because if you draw so there's actually the edges of the bubble are more close to the ground. So if you give it a speed v, it starts to roll, sort of tumble. So this part hits the surface because there's more mass over it, and it evaporates. And so that there's a tumbling effect going on. So yes.
So what we've seen with this experiment is that theoretically, even
sometimes practically,
even a cooler pan can evaporate water more quickly, and a hotter pan is going to produce an interesting effect in which the water sloshes around and moves with its own accord.
You'll notice there is still water in here, a little bit. It hasn't quite evaporated yet. But you have cool. No, it's balanced.
I've seen another interesting experiment by this effect too. I think the man who did this was the third author of Heliogeric Physics, Gerald Walker, or some. I think it was him. I'm not sure. He actually stuck his hand in liquid. What do you call it? PB? In liquid lead, and then out, and nothing happened. But if it's not hot enough, you will have a layer of PB around your hand, but if it's hot enough, the water, your sweat evaporates and forms a layer around your hand and protects it, actually.
It's
and that's an experiment that takes a lot of guts.
You can also do this walking of blowing bubbles.
Yes.
Putting out a candle with your fingers, it's the same thing, so you lit them before you snuff out a candle. The layer of steam protects your fingers.
Jump in a volcano.
Excellent.
So, what determines the minimum in that curve?
This one?
It's the Leyden Frost point. Impurities in the water, it's a substance, it depends on a lot of things.
The surface and the material, the convection.
Should be at about 160 degrees C.
So when it keeps going up, is this because you reached a point where it's so hot that you conduct through the steam and fast enough to heat it again? Okay.
Yes, just sometimes it just you get don't worry.
What's the point? Does it start to drop?
Does it peak out?
Yes. Presumably, in order for there to be a dip, there has to be a peak somewhere in between.
It's somewhere between 100 and 160, right? This graph, the cross point was around 160 degrees,
yeah.
And the zero there is boiling point.
Oh, right.
But it depends a lot on the circumstance we are using.
Right, but the main point is that it starts dropping because at some point you're vaporizing the water fast enough. So you have to be past the boiling point, obviously.
Yeah.
And it has to be enough heat transfer so that you leak, that there's enough of the air steam there.
Yeah, right. And the rate of heat
brings the maximum.
It does depend on the pan you're using.
Right.
So the effects still occur if you fill the entire bottom of the pan? You must add much more heat. Because
You can put a lot of water in and it'll still happen.
But that would move your Leyden Frost point to a higher temperature.
Yes.
I don't think so, because the heat in the pan will just go there, and you must add much more heat to the steam there.
I think that would be like a really, you could see like bubbles flowing the air circulating in the center and it would get to go off with.
Obviously, if you had a thick enough layer of water, the gravity of the water and the pressure of the water would not be able to be held up by the layer of steam. So if you're boiling a whole pot of water, you're not going to see it if you heat up the pot a lot. But you see it with like a thin layer of water covering the entire pan. Because you can got huge bubbles that are moving around.
You can also clean your house with this effect. By pouring liquid nitrogen on the floor,
mm-hmm. when
a little droplets when they tumble, they pick up dust and take it to the collect to the next to the wall and stuff. I actually done it last summer. I accidentally spilled some liquid nitrogen in the lab while doing ice cream.
Yes. Sibra, you had a question.
I have the same question as Trevor's.
Yeah.
Did you try any quantitative estimates of the temperature? The balance, the downward pressure with the upward pressure from the steam, just treat the steam as an ideal gas in some temperature?
No, because it depended so much on the surface. Everything we read, it said, like, you know, if you do this in a lab, you may have to have a consistent surface, and we don't know the conduction of these pans.
Feels
yeah.
But you know
the temperature.
You know the pressure of an ideal gas, so
it's hard to
work out whether that will lift the water off the surface.
It's
but we
it's hard.
We don't know the temperature though. We know that it's set at like number one.
Sure, but doing the calculation is actually quite possible. And the other thing that you can do quite easily, of course, if you want to do a real experiment, which you know would be fun to me, is to take. You know, to do it at various temperatures to see how long it takes.
Right.
And also, there is a length scale. There are many length scale effects here as well, right? Because of the pressure versus the mass, which scales in a different way. So all these effects would mean that it'd be very interesting to look at, you know, a small droplet versus a large droplet and how all that scales. You could do the calculation, I think, pretty easily. Maybe not with all the pre-factors built in, but at least qualitatively to get the behavior.
Do you think it depends on the surface tension or what?
So I was just thinking the same thing. You think because then the droplets don't form the same shape, right, the same amount of water, you know, spherical. And you know, we do notice if you put in a big enough droplet, it does split into little ones. And some of the small ones do join together. So they're not quite stable. Anything else?
Okay, great, thank you. Okay, who wants to go next? All right. So,
we need to go downstairs.
Okay, good. Today we're going to talk about density. Our experimental apparatus is set up in the backyard, so I'd like y'all to go down there.
Okay.
for tourism.
Oh, what are canyons?
Unless you're sort of, I believe he's getting it from that camera right here. Right?
Okay, yeah.
So what's on this camera will be projected right there.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay, that's what we want. Yeah, that's what we want.
There you go.
Let me try. We want to see if we can get. We need a slightly tilted back. Yeah, well, we don't care about the camera, we just care about the back. Okay, why don't you just do this? If you get something like this, can you shine the laser in the camera? Yes. Shine the laser. No.
What did you want them to focus on?
So, what they had before when you saw it inside the pots, we want something like that.
What is he trying to video?
Oh, the dot behind the...
Oh, yeah, okay, so...
So, this, the light on the screen?
Yeah, as it's on the screen, you can see it's a little fine.
Yeah.
Okay. That's another presentation. Hi everybody. So here we're going to present something that is easy to do, safe to do, which you can do at home, which doesn't require a big garbage can. So we're going to do with a laser pointer. Kids, do
you not to look into it if you don't want to lose one of your eyes. So, so today we're going to convince you that light is a way. So we're going to start by doing some single slit experiment, and then we're going to move on to calculate the wavelength of a laser pen. Hi.
Could you move it just slightly that way, because you can't video the screen when it's shooting itself. Apparently you get feedback. So,
you can get shot. No, if you move it to that way, then we can
No, that way you have it is good, I think.
Oh, okay, here it's good.
You want to see the pattern you're projecting onto the screen, right?
Okay. Yeah.
What?
Okay, so so first we're going to do a single slit experiment performed by Madame Beth. So these are specially constructed index cards, are very high tech, and they are sticked together so that the slits are of a slight V shape. So what you should be able to observe is that as the slit gets smaller, you can see the
diffraction pattern spreads out.
Yes.
Yep, can you see it?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is up at the top where it's thin. Do you see the diffraction pattern?
There
you
go.
See, you see
it's the original with hair.
And then you go down
to
her slit. You see the diffraction pattern?
So you can see that the size is size of the distance between the diffraction pattern is kind of proportional to the size of the slit. That's what we want to observe. And this happens because light is a wave.
There's actually another explanation that I've heard of the uncertainty principle, because the more certain you are of the position, the less certain you are of the momentum. So it will spread out because you don't know what direction it's going into, so it goes. It will, because if you know the position that it's going through, and do more if you know the position closer, if the slit is smaller, you know this direction, because it's very narrow, it causes it to spread out and come back because you don't know the momentum at that point in that small slit.
So, if anybody is interested, you can come over at the end of the class, and you can see on the screen how intricate those pattern is, because it actually is very beautiful to see. Yeah. So let's move on to the next project, calculating the wavelength of a laser pen, which I'm sure every single child would be interested in doing.
So, like this here. These things have little slits, but instead of having one slit here, these devices have multiple slits. This particular one has 1,000 lines per millimeter, and this has 2,200 lines per millimeter. Pass this around. And if you look at it, if you look at a light source, you'll be able to see the rainbow. You'll be able to see like rainbows, or say if you were to look at the fluorescent light source, which is not on right now, you see discrete images of different colors, because what happens is the distance in which it's spread out is dependent on the wavelength. Go to the conclusion.
Okay, so we're now going to do our experiment to determine the wavelength of the laser. Okay, so I'm shining it through. I need to see the
Let's
it's holding such that it is perpendicular to the string, yes. String and perpendicular
yes.
To the.
So,
yeah, so determining the calculation simple will, the distance between the screen and the diffraction grating will be approximately, or exactly 1 meter.
Okay, so. 1 meter?
This is exactly 1 meter.
You're nowhere near 1 meter.
No, this is precisely to the. Oh, sorry. Okay. Exactly 9 meter, precise to the 10th decimal place. It's more accurate than the size of an electron. Okay. Okay. So now please measure the distance between the two dots. So the distance between those are exactly 15 centimeters. Precise to the 13th decimal place. This is all very high there.
It's 14.4.
Yes, so that's exactly 15. If you use the 17th century, you
work out last night, don't you?
Yes. Okay. No, you guys explain the math.
All right, so we're going to go through the theory. So we're drawing a pair. Okay. So we're just doing two of these lists, but the whole diffraction grating works the same, obviously. So here is... okay, so here are two slits of the diffraction grating. That's what this is. And over here is important. And we're just doing a two-dimensional division. So we've got our linear beams coming, you know, we've got lots of rays going this way. So we have one coming through. This is a point where there is constructive energy. Yeah. So do you want to go ahead? No. Okay. All right. So this theta is just defined to be the measurement from the central point to the point of interest. And so we know that to have constructive interference, you have to have the difference between this ray and this ray. Yeah. It has to be some multiple of the wavelength. So we can make the approximation that this angle is equal to this theta because this is so long compared to the width of the slits, right? That this line is essentially perpendicular to this line, right? Yeah, exactly. So then we have a theta here. And then you just retrace and
exact measurement of our exact experiment that L is exactly 1 meter and X is exactly 15 centimeter. And D is the distance between the, yes, it is exactly 5.4 times 10 to the minus 9 nanometer. Data pointer wrong. Any questions?
which is actually a 6.
Right, I thought so. It's just upside down.
So this is something that you can safely perform in the kitchen. And if you don't want to be a pirate for the rest of your life, don't you look into a laser?
Okay.
That was late.
Any other questions?
No?
Alright.
Okay, I guess we're perfect.
Who's next?
This won't be a safe experiment.
Good morning, everyone. Today we'll try to show you a physical effect that we think is quite cool. But we found out yesterday that it's not that easy to do it. So what do we have? Ricardo here. He will try to demonstrate the ping pong ball. So please. Well, don't worry. We have a lot of balls. We can keep going. So the effect we're trying to show you is the curve ball. That I guess you have seen in a lot of sports. In your sports, right? You have in football and basketball. Baseball, you have ping pong.
What
happened?
I don't have the
boss to continue. No, don't worry. Pat will try to show you with the football.
Actual soccer ball here.
We done it with the football.
Football. So, yeah, right. And they left me with two choices. Either I can kick the ball in your face it, and I can leave it to a professional using the computer. So I can put the second choice. I don't know whether you know him. It's Roberto Carlos. He has a very excellent free kick, a masterpiece of footballer.
Put it in full screen.
Look at the ball. So,
full screen.
Full screen.
Full screen.
So, pay attention
now.
Is that a game for France against Brazil?
Yeah. In the replay, follow the path of the ball.
Now you're gonna see it. This camera, pay attention. You see this going now, and it's changed right there. Freedom,
this is you. This is the best one. This is the best one.
And the goalkeeper is giving his move.
Look at the ball.
Now that's a goal. That's why we're trying to get, but none of us could really hit the ball. Well, to explain this effect, we'll lend the microphone to Bruno.
Well, first of all, I don't know if you have noticed, but the ball was rotating. If you try to kick a football or with a ping pong ball or a baseball or any sort of ball, if you just throw it straight, that won't happen anything like that. It has to be rotated. And why is that? What? Imagine that we have a ball, and the ball is rotating like this. Now, we have to imagine how the air will flow around football, or general ball. And the thing is that, while rotating, the ball will drag some of the air with it. So, if you think of the airflow, going like this, when it starts hitting the ball, it will accompany the rotation, and it will go like this, and like this, and like this. And from this side, it will go more or less straighter. So, by rotating, the air will be forcing lots of air to come through this side with a high velocity. Like this. And here with a smaller velocity. And according to this gentleman, Bernoulli, he said that when we have a fluid with a higher velocity, the pressure is lower. So here we have small pressure, and here we have higher pressure. So what will happen is that the ball will actually be set towards this side, and we'll have a general force going like this, which will make the ball curve in this way, which makes sense, because if you want to make the ball to arc like this, you know that you have to kick it this way, so that it will start rotating like this. Well, but actually, this might not be so simple as this, because the Bernoulli explanation is more the common one, but it is still a matter of discussion, and there are still people who discuss if it's really because of Bernoulli effect or some other hydrodynamical question. So it is not that easy. But now that at least we have a general idea of how this works, it's pretty much the same way our airplane wing works. Like by being rotating, the ball actually turns into a airplane wing. But now that we have a general idea of how this might work, I think I will ask Bob to try the ball.
Let me tell you one thing. I know how it works, but I can't do this. But Robert Carlos doesn't know how it works, but he does. So that might be actually why he makes a lot more money than I do. So we prepare to finish our demonstration with another masterpiece of this.
Before reaching the supersonic regime, because if we think like
the friction force,
if you take in consideration frictional force, the effect actually is opposite of this one. It will try to make the ball go curve that way. So, and if we actually see when the ball is like going really fast, sometimes you see a ball doing like this. So I think that's probably when friction starts becoming
important. It's an answer, so I think I answered the question like this. You kick a ball like that, and then I'd like to explain.
This is a very complicated problem, and you just try to find a simple explanation.
You can also try to think about turbulence. That's even more complicated.
Yeah, the turbulence makes it even more interesting, this goal, because when you kick the ball, like the first one, it actually goes in a straight line, and it's clearly going to miss. And then it starts curving later on. I think that's because of the turbulence, this boundary layer. The boundary layer stops it from doing this.
This kick, there was a huge amount of debate between physicists about how he did this. And I've seen the calculations, they've modeled the ball to spin 10 complete rounds a second. It's very, fast spinning. So
actually, we have done a simple calculation, and we got an acceleration, like the same order of magnitude as a gravitational acceleration. So, well, mid-Reynolds effect, so... Bernoulli's effect is probably a good explanation. Might be not the real one,
So you mentioned that there's still some controversy about whether it is. So what are the other alternative ways of thinking about
that?
What
is boundary layer effect?
No, the boundary detection, that the air flowing on site is so fast that it detaches, because when it detaches on the volume, it creates some turbulence and it kind of drags on the
like think of a resistor, for example. The air kind of detaches from the back of the car, and then there's this place with less air that one can go faster in it because there's less drag. That's kind of the same, except the drag isn't balanced so that it can make the ball curve.
But the most common that we've seen is this fine turbulence.
This is the same thing as a wing plane. Say that the wing plane is something like this, and the air has to flow quicker on the upper side and the downside. And they usually the most common explanation is that the lift force is also because of Bernoulli effect.
Yeah.
But there are some people that say that probably that's not the real reason, and that the airplanes fly because of also the boundary layer detection.
That's the exact same
question.
Yeah.
Is
there some question there?
I was just going to say, I think, the aerofoil thing, that's the Bernoulli effect. This is called the Magnus Robbins effect.
Yeah, Magnus.
Yes,
Magnus.
Yeah.
But to explain the Magnus effect, that they use the Bernoulli equation.
Yeah, we used to be.
It's one of the explanations.
It's a slightly different effect, though, right? You have something spinning. And
yeah. Any more questions?
Okay, thank you very much.
Stick
could see like the magnet is deflecting the wire here. So suddenly the copper wire seemed to have a magnetic property, whereas it didn't before. So what's happening here is when you take and attach the wire to a battery, it creates a current that flows around the wire. So there's moving charged particles in that wire. And when charged particles interact with the magnetic field, you end up with a force. And the force law is given by F is equal to Q V, which is the charge of the particle, velocity of the particle, cross with the magnetic field B. So
maybe the best way to like picture this is if you have a constant. And you have a charged particle here, and it's moving this way. How will it move?
What's the charge?
To the left.
Yes.
To the right.
Right. So that's the like the intuition behind this. Like.
Okay.
Okay. Now we have this. This is wire that is like wound into this coil, it's like a spiral, and we have like a, I don't know what this material is.
Steel.
Okay, so this is steel, and there is a ferromagnetic core, and the idea is that if I use if I try to like attract the
screw.
It won't. So now if I cars and they want to destroy the cars, they take them to a cemetery of cars and they have these drugs. They just do the same thing. They trap the car and then they destroy the car.
Okay, so we can see that magnets attract things, but why? So, for example, I can use this coin, right, to pick up another coin. See, these coins are attached to the coin. So, effectively, the coin that touches the magnet becomes the magnet itself. And the reason this is because inside the magnet there are little structures called domains, each of which have a north and south pole, just like the big magnet. And they are aligned so that you get a net magnetic effect. But in a point, you also have domains, but they're random, pointing in random directions. So if I am holding this point in the magnetic field, the domains in the point align along the direction of the magnetic field. So if I were to hold it in the magnetic field, then I can use the point to pick up another point. And if I remove the magnetic field, the magnetic domains disalign again, so that the coin becomes unmagnetic. Okay. So there's another trick you can do, And to show that it's a magnet is by, okay? You can attach a point like this, and then if you have another, do the same thing. Okay, and then I hold, if you hold the thing. So you get it right. So those points are magnetized, and these points are magnetized. Now, if we keep the points together, you can see that the points attract each other, because what we're doing is that we were holding the points underneath each of the poles of the magnet, and basically, if this is a north pole, then the bottom of this point becomes the north pole, and the point beneath the south pole became the bottom of that became the south pole, so they attracted each other. But if we hold the points beneath the same pole, then you get that the bottoms of the points become like poles, and we know that like poles of magnets repel each other. Okay, so.
So here I've got some much stronger magnets, which are the same ones we used yesterday, and a screw. So now the screw is magnetized because it's in the magnetic field, just like we saw over here. So that means that we can put it on the bottom of the battery like this. So now if I connect this terminal of the battery to one of the magnets, there'll be current flowing through the magnet, up through the screw, and form a complete circle. So let's see what happens when this works. And it spins quite fast, so I'll let you pass on down, but be careful you don't flow into the battery, because it'll keep spinning for a long time, because it's a very low friction bearing, it's just a screw cool stuff on. So we can see how that works. So here we've got our battery, and we're feeding current through the magnet here and up through the screw. Now, because this is a magnet, we've got a magnetic field going inside the magnet, and we're passing the current this way. And so, like we demonstrated with the wire, this means that we'll get a force. If here we've got a magnetic field going up and current going in, which way will the force be on the side of the magnet? Into our little edge. Out?
Yep.
So that means that this is coming to the outer cage, so we'll end up with a torque which spins the magnet like this. And because it's quite a low friction bearing, because it's just stuck on, you can get it going very fast. I'll see if I can do a second one.
Just something. Can you give me one of the copper wires? No. Because they stopped and then I can pass.
No, it's
a
good one. Doing this drains the battery very quickly. I'll drain this battery completely, so we'll see how fast we can get it going before. So
And so that's a neat little thing which is called a homopolar generator. That's our homopolar motor. You do the same in reverse and make a generator. So that was just a little trick that sort of brings together a couple of nice concepts with electromagnetism. Any questions?
Any applications of this?
Well, I mean, yeah, the electric motor. In terms of this specifically, not so much, I don't think.
I remember in Star Wars Episode 3, there was Obi-Wan was chasing the droid king on basically a one-wheel automobile that might have been like a big magnet where you have the current going through the wheel.
Sorry, and just cast the name of the movie.
Stalls episode 3.
Oh, I see.
So you could, in principle, use this for as it would to drive wheels. I don't know how economic that would be, but
it's usually you want to get very large speeds, but you don't need a lot of torque because, I mean, as soon as you put friction on this, you know, it slows down, so you can't drive very much. But they have used it to study very high speed systems because you can almost get like special relativity effects beginning to happen if you do it properly and go very fast.
Well, what would be the special relativity effect?
Disclaimer, I'm not entirely sure on this. But because you're outside the magnet.
Sorry, the thing is hard if you, never mind.
You move very fast, you get length contraction, so you get an increase in the sort of charge per unit volume, so then you can get, I think, potential across the magnet. But I couldn't explain deeply how it works, I'm afraid. But it's mainly sort of this particular demonstration is more sort of a curiosity. But you know, you can build, I mean, the principle applies to lots of motors and generators out there. Any other questions?
So, like the diagram on the blackboard, like by the right hand motion, it's like spin the other way.
Someone just told me out of the page, I believe.
It depends which way the batteries.
Yeah, right.
Doesn't
it
just say that electrons travel
down? So let's say we've got the electrons traveling down here. Then, I mean, if you visual, so we've got negative charges going in. So V cross B, V cross B, it's out of the page, you can go charge with this. That's great. No more questions?
Was that it?
No, we have to be
okay.
Alright, hello everyone. So today we're going to have some fun with balloons.
and maybe along the way learn something about surface tension. So, can I please have a volunteer from the audience?
Yep.
Oh, Catherine. Alright, now I want you to examine these windows.
They're black.
Okay. Is there any difference between them? No. Are they the same?
Yeah.
Alright. Same color, same size. Okay, now, you blow it up.
We can do it.
Now, I want you to blow it up the same size that mine is.
Are they really the same?
Well, you don't trust Catherine, and you like to examine the balloons for yourself?
That's quite hard.
Catherine, if you just hold the top and squeeze the balloon, it'll stretch it. Make it easier.
Yeah.
That would be going back.
Yeah. Far away, you can guess what.
Alright, yeah.
So it's going
okay. So So I want you to stand behind the balloons and open the mouth. Turn it toward you. Alright, so can you think of why this might happen? Or are you completely mystified?
If we were first years, we'd be completely mystified.
I'm completely mystified. Well, I'm sure there's people in his audience who are also mystified.
Okay, so then I'll talk from Hoffy and Emma to explain what's happening.
It's quite easy, but since everyone tend to expect for symmetry, so it's kind of surprising. But the fact is, P equals... this is the coefficient of the surface tension, and this is the medium of the blue, if it's a sphere. And this is the pressure of the gas. I won't go for the details, but it's easy to see. The surface tension, its definition is, this is dense. And since F is proportional to R, and the area is proportional to R squared, so it's easy to see the pressure here is proportional to 1 over R. So
therefore, the larger radius, the blue with the larger radius will have smaller pressure, so that the air will flow in.
Anyone wants the detail, or you want much better? Because I can explain it.
Okay. Any questions?
So, if the balloon, if you blow a balloon up sufficiently far, it'll burst. Is this effect strong enough, or do other effects kick in at that point? If I had a small balloon with enough air to make a big, pretty full balloon burst, would it make it burst? Do you know?
I think at that point, since there is air flowing in the valve, it would probably just go back the other way. But we didn't try that.
It doesn't seem like that this balloon is exerting a much larger force, but as we were playing around, we had a bag of all different kinds of balloons. One thing we noticed was that the really small balloons are really hard to blow up. Yeah. So, you can, we have a whole bag full of them if you want to mess around with them. Yes, Felix?
Is it related to that, when the balloon is smaller, it's hard to blow up? Even if you,
yes.
Is it
yes.
The same thing?
Yeah.
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 Awesome. Okay.
Yeah, so if I can just comment on this, because in a weird way this is somewhat related to my research. So the question that you had is what happens as the balloon gets larger, and the reality is that this equation is actually the demonstration is excellent. It demonstrates this equation, but this equation is for surface tension, and balloons don't behave in a normal way as surface tension of the soap bubble does, for example. So if you were to do it with soap bubbles, then absolutely, we just empty and eventually it'll burst, okay? In the case of the rubber balloon, what happens is that the surface tension actually, the surface tension increases over time, okay? Because at some point, you're stretching all the molecules to a point where they can't get stretched any further, and that's when you get the bursting. So the reality is, it would go to a point, and then it probably wouldn't burst because the actual surface tension increases. If I might just take the opportunity a little bit further, there's a really nice, one of the things that we've done in our research is we look at a lot of anisotropic fluids. And so basically, so it's kind of, think of a liquid crystal, right? A liquid crystal is ordered. Well, there's other polymeric examples of things like liquid crystals that form layers. And so in that case, what happens is that you can create a situation where you have small islands or small holes in a film, and essentially, because it's an anisotropic system, it's layers, it means that it's the equivalent of a two-dimensional version of a bubble. So you have a big island and a little island that are side by side, or a big hole and a little hole that are side by side, and what you have is individual molecules diffusing through the layer and going from the little island to the big island. So the big islands get larger, the small islands get smaller, and vice versa. And that's a two-dimensional analog of exactly
the same thing as fat bubbles, like on a soup. You've seen this.
Yes, absolutely. It's all the same thing. It's all the same thing. It's the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. But you could do the exact same calculation where you go through it and you use an edge tension instead of having a surface tension, which you have for a surface. For the two-dimensional equivalent, you have what's called a line tension or an edge tension. It's exactly the same physics. Any other questions?
Sorry, I just have a question about blackboard. What is F?
This one?
Yeah.
And F is the force.
Okay, so what is sigma?
Sigma is coefficient of surface tension.
Okay, and what is df by dl? What is that L?
It's a it's force of one point. It's and this is the strength. It's
less. Is it force per unit area?
About it be like the smaller balloon must get smaller because the final surface area of the two balloons is smaller than if the smaller one gets bigger.
Absolutely. So one way that you can do it is you can just write down the free energy of the system. The free energy of the system is equal to the surface area of one balloon plus the surface area of the other balloon. And then you just minimize the free energy and you get exactly the same thing out. Okay. And that tells you the dynamics then as well, which is really nice about this. So there's one other question, which was, so the units are indeed, it's a force per unit length, or an energy per unit area.
So along that line, if we had balloons which weren't circular, but were like the long ones. Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Yeah, cool.
Because
we're building out in surfaces, even if they have different forms.
And you write forces.
What was the question?
The question was, you use the long balloons because they have the same circumference around, they don't get bigger this way. It's just like a, how long they are. It won't work. Or it didn't work.
Yeah, nothing happens.
Yeah, it's more of a question to Ferry, I suppose. You said you can do it in like two dimensions as well. Are there any dimensions where the opposite happens? Like in a theoretical sense, like if you use 10 dimensions, does it switch around?
Yeah, I work in three or two dimensions. the thing is that the physics here is not dependent on the dimensions in which you do it. So I would say it doesn't matter. If there's a case where you can write the surface tension
yeah.
or surface energy yeah. as a function of multiple dimensions, then you can do the whole same. You go through exactly the same calculation.
Yeah,
you write down the free energy. You minimize the free energy, and you know.
But sometimes the minimization might be from like maximizing the surface area or something. If you go to like a really low dimension or a fractal dimension.
Well, typically for this kind of physics, you always tend towards minimizing the surface area because the surface area is a cost, right? It's an energy per unit area. So the free energy of the system always drives towards a minimum. So what would happen is that you're always minimizing the surface area. So you need other physics involved in order to get, for example, to have a surface become fractal-like, right? Or to have a surface have strange patterns to it, which happens all the time, like waves or whatever. or the I guess it's the Safman-Taylor instability, where you take a liquid and of higher density over liquid of lower temperature, lower density, and you let the liquid fall through gravity. So this is like the gas nebula and things like that, where you see striations, right? You see these beautiful striations. And that is because there's some other physics that's at play. But if this is the only physics in it, then it's just minimization of the surface area of the system. And I guess Heather just pointed out we were just talking about the case of the cylindrical balloons, and you know, why does it not happen in that case? And again, if you were to write down the surface area of the one balloon plus the surface area of the other balloon, if you assume that all that the circumference stays the same, all that changes is the length, then there's no minimization of free energy, right? You can take it all on this side or all on that side, and it doesn't change the free energy. It's only because you have this other dimension in this case.
Have
you been on
the
screen? Yeah. Well, we had those valves. They had those valves in the hardware store, but we got that one.
Thank you very much. So I guess we'll stop at that point. What I would say is some of the demonstrations were really, really well done. Some of them were less well done. Practice makes perfect. The other thing is that as far as demos are concerned, you know, they often don't work. It's just the way it goes. And so actually, one of the difficulties in coming up with a series of demonstrations that actually works is that, you know, you need to practice a lot, and you need to make them totally foolproof, which is very, very difficult. I mean, it's reality. Even when I did the Xenon demonstration, right? I started doing a Xenon demonstration and panicked at one point because I realized my gas tank had emptied out. I mean, this happens, right? So, but a good demo, a really, really good demo, is one that really does not fail, or fails very, very infrequently.
Yeah, if Neil had drowned, that would have been a bad thing.
What's that?
If Neil had drowned.
Yes. That'd be bad.
But I mean, I think that, like, you can't always plan for every contingency, so, like, if something doesn't work, you can still learn something, you can still get people to learn something, or,
absolutely.
Still go on and, you know,
yeah. Absolutely. It's easy to recover from these things, and it's all about, I mean, getting people involved in the whole process, right? And they don't, I mean, if most of it goes right and something goes wrong, it's only funny, right? The things that go wrong are the best. If you break the plates as you pull out the tablecloth, it makes demonstration that much more funny. I'm willing to stick around for a bit longer if anybody wants to talk about presentations. If people are okay, then I think we'll stop at this point, okay? But feel free to come up to me afterwards if you have any questions.
So I guess we'll email out a timetable for tomorrow's talks.
Yes.
Arrange one. If you haven't already put your titles and how you're doing the talk on the wiki, you need to do that. We'll come and chase you up. Computers. So we could give an update with the computers.
I haven't received any emails.
Oh, I've got the choice. Okay. So
was it chicken?
They figured out how to get the filters printing, but unfortunately it means that the IT people actually have to fix the,
oh, yeah.
You know, come and sort your computers for you. So some people have already had it done, but they're going to be around again this afternoon, I hope. Similar to yesterday, I think probably about 2 o'clock here. So if your computer isn't printing, then you might want to come back at 2 o'clock to get it sorted.
Anything else?
Lunch again.
Lunch in the basement at any time after 12. Yeah. If you have any other computer problems, come back at 2 and enjoy over here again.
Please give the magnets a bag.
Oh, it's yours? Well, no, they're not ours, that's probably.